A well-known Japanese company admits it's been fudging the books for years.
How did Olympus get away with it?
From APM, American Public Media. Hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org on this Tuesday, the 8th day of November.
Coming up, borrowing costs reach record levels in Italy, and Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi may be on the way out.
Has billboard advertising gotten out of control?
And a look at the numbers on a big day for the video game industry.
Those stories and much more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
We're going to start with a big economic story out of Japan today. Camera maker Olympus admitted that it covered up huge losses dating all the way back to the 1980s. Executives reportedly paid inflated fees to advisors as part of the scheme, a reverse from earlier denials that the firm had done anything wrong. Well, Olympus stock has lost about a third of its value right after that announcement, and the BBC's Roland Burke is in Tokyo, where the company is based. He's got that story for us. Hi, Roland.
Hi.
Tell us what happened at Olympus.
Well, essentially what we're looking at here is possibly the largest corporate fraud, or one of them, in Japanese history. It all started back in mid-October when the British president and chief executive, Michael Woodford, who'd only been there 6 months, raised questions about a number of transactions. Olympus had paid $687 million in advisory fees to firms, one in the United States, one in the Cayman Islands. They'd bought three Japanese companies, small ones, for $1 billion nearly, and then written down the value several years later. For weeks now, Olympus has been saying nothing wrong, but now they've admitted that those payments were actually going to cover up huge losses they've been making in share dealing dating back to the 1990s, a massive incident of corporate misgovernance.
And some of these deals date back many, many years, Roland. I mean, how could this have gone on for so long?
I think that it raises the issue in Japan of corporate governance, of just how independent boards are, of just how willing people are who tend at the top of these companies to work for one firm for life to challenge other members of boards. Certainly for Olympus, they're paying a very heavy price. Today, their shares were down by 29%, the maximum allowed fall in a single day. And since all this began in mid-October, the company's lost 70% of its value. So its very survival is in doubt. And we are hearing reports here in Tokyo that the FBI is investigating as well.
The BBC's Roland Burke in Tokyo. Roland, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, for more on this, let's bring in Julie Neiman, analyst at Smith Moore & Company. She's with us from St. Louis, as she is every Tuesday. Good morning.
Morning, Jeremy.
So how can a company like Olympus hide the truth from everyone for so long?
Well, this is the time when all generalizations apply. My favorite's Uncle Warren's adage, you don't know who's swimming naked until the tide goes out. And that means the basic bad economic times expose fraud. 2001, we had Enron, Global Crossing, Sunbeam, WorldCom. Now we have Bernie Madoff, Bear Stearns, Lehman, AIG, and Olympus in Japan. So it really is international. When times are really good, fraud's papered over with money, and that's campaign contributions to everybody who's doing the governing. They look the other way. They don't enforce the laws that Congress passes. You know, Congress passes a lot of good laws to protect consumers, the environment, and, you know, just everybody. But they slash the budgets of the agencies so they have little ability to enforce. So everybody's outmanned, outgunned, and the fraudsters get away with murder.
And Julie, quickly, is there any way to recover, regain trust from something like this?
Well, assuming that the company still has some base that's viable, economically viable, and most of them have to liquidate, the only way you regain credibility is to fire everyone but the janitor and change the name. So hopefully there's collective amnesia in the future.
Julie Neiman, analyst with Smith Moore & Company, thanks so much.
You bet.
Well, another Japanese company is in the news today. Toyota said today profit fell by more than 18% in its last quarter, blamed on everything from natural disasters to Japan's currency exchange rate. Here's Marketplace's Jeff Tyler.
Last spring, the tsunami in Japan hurt Toyota's ability to crank out new cars. Production had been picking up again when floods hit Thailand. Jeremy Anwil is CEO of Edmunds.com.
Thailand is a major supplier of components, and the plants in Thailand have really been underwater now for about a month. So what that's caused Toyota to do, particularly in the United States, is cut back on production.
The strong Japanese yen also works against Toyota. The dollars aren't worth as much when converted into yen. Morningstar analyst David Whiston says compared to other Japanese car makers, the strong yen will hurt Toyota the most.
They are the most dependent on that yen-dollar exchange rate because of the big three Japanese, they actually produce the most in Japan compared to the other guys.
All the more incentive for Toyota to build cars in the U.S. Good timing there. After several delays, Toyota is expected to begin production at a big new manufacturing plant in Mississippi later this month. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Well, from one struggling car maker to one that may not survive at all, General Motors today rejected a plan for two Chinese companies to take over Swedish automaker Saab. GM is still a preferred shareholder in Saab. Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports.
The deal for two Chinese companies to take over Saab was a confusing one from the start for auto industry analyst Michael Dunn. One of the investors seemed a little green.
The lead on this, Pang Da, is actually a dealer group in China with no car manufacturing experience.
And Saab has been a money loser for some time, so why do these companies want to save it? Dunn says even though Saab's brand is dying, there are still important GM parts under their hoods.
When the Chinese come in and buy Saab, they're actually buying into access to GM's best technology. And that makes GM unhappy. Nope, we don't want that to happen.
In essence, says Dunn, this was a not-so-elaborate plan by the Chinese to gain access to GM's engine and chassis technology. That's something GM won't even share with its long-term partner in China, he says. GM says it'll stop supplying components and technology if the Chinese succeed with their bid for Saab. Dunn estimates that'll cut the price of Saab in half. In other words, no deal, putting Saab back on the road to bankruptcy. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
Now to Italy, where worries about the country's finances have sent borrowing costs to a new record this morning. The Italian parliament is voting today on public finances, and if the vote fails, it could spell the end of Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi's leadership. At the time of this podcast being recorded, the vote is going on. For more, we're joined from Rome by the BBC's David Willey. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, David, do the Italians think that getting rid of Berlusconi would calm the markets?
In a sense, I think that Mr. Berlusconi has already departed. His departure has been discounted by the markets. They rallied a bit. They've been very volatile over the past few days. But Italy's borrowing costs have grown to the extent that the experts are saying that they've reached a point where it's not going to be possible for Italy to service its debts in the future. And this is really very worrying.
And you've been reporting from Italy, David, since the 70s. I mean, how significant would it be if Berlusconi were to go because of this debt crisis?
Well, it brings an era of Italian political life to an end. Mr. Berlusconi has dominated Italian politics for almost two decades, and his departure would be a radical change. But of course, there is no quick fix here. Italy, though, is the third biggest economy in Europe, in the European Union, and it does have, for example, big gold reserves. This is not a country that's teetering on the edge of complete bankruptcy. It's simply lost credibility under Mr. Berlusconi. And Italians hope that if he departs, when he departs, things might get better, but it's going to take time.
The BBC's David Willey in Rome. Thanks, David.
Today in Ohio, voters will decide the fate of the state's new law limiting the collective bargaining rights of public workers. A state ballot initiative seeks to repeal the law, which affects more than 350,000 unionized government employees. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer has more.
Supporters of the law are using TV ads to paint public workers as fat cats.
It's not right that hardworking Ohioans have sacrificed, yet still have to foot the bill for government workers' gold-plated health benefits and automatic pay raises.
Government workers are supposed to get automatic raises, but many gave them up this year because of Ohio's tough economy. In general, the state's workers do have good benefits, but they accepted lower salaries in return. John Green teaches political science at the University of Akron.
The overall package may be really pretty good compared to the private sector, but there's a different mix of salary, wages, and benefits.
Harley Shakin is a labor economist at Berkeley. He says the issue is more than just public sector pay and benefits, because the law puts strict limits on whether government employees can negotiate their working conditions.
I think at the end of the day, the referendum is about the basic right to have a union and to negotiate.
This issue isn't confined to Ohio. Wisconsin has passed a similar law, and other states are watching closely. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
So, some sad news out late yesterday that boxing legend Joe Frazier has passed away. Mm. He was probably best remembered for a legendary rivalry against Muhammad Ali. In 1971, he handed Ali his first professional defeat in the fight of the century at Madison Square Garden.
Yeah, what a fight that was. At the time, these big matches were heavily hyped. But it seems as though now boxing has sort of fallen off the radar of mainstream American sports fans. In today's Midday Extra, we ask, how has boxing and the business of boxing changed over the years? And here to talk with us now is Thomas Hauser. He's author of a number of books on boxing, and he's with us this morning on the line. Hi, Thomas.
Hi, good to be with you.
So, Thomas, first tell us, what kind of impact did Joe Frazier and the rivalry he had with Muhammad Ali have on the sport?
Ali Frazier was one of the great rivalries, not just in boxing, but in all sports. They fought three fights that were the pyramids of boxing, and they'll always be linked together in people's minds.
The three fights, of course. You had the fight of the century, you had the Thrilla in Manila, and all of those, right, in the 70s.
Yeah, the first fight really was deserving of the title Fight of the Century. There were three fights that captured the imagination of America like none other. The first was Jack Johnson against Jim Jeffries. Then came the second fight between Joe Louis and Max Schmeling. And finally, there was the first Ali Frazier fight in 1971. Because of the advances in satellite transmission, that really captured the imagination of the world.
So here we are so many years later, Thomas, and you know, there's so much communication and satellite. I mean, how many TV channels do we have now, and boxing isn't near what it used to be? How can that be?
Boxing, unfortunately, has become a niche sport in the United States. And one of the reasons for that is that the sport no longer has readily identifiable champions. There was a time when the heavyweight championship was the most coveted title in sports. And now, because of a surplus of greedy world sanctioning organizations, each television network wants a championship fight every month. Theoretically, you have four heavyweight champions of the world, and it ruins the sport. The purpose of any sport, really, you know, for the viewing public, is to crown a champion. We were all just excited about baseball because you had the World Series. Everybody understood that the St. Louis Cardinals weren't necessarily the best team in baseball. The Philadelphia Phillies and the New York Yankees had much better records during the year, but the Cardinals are the world champions. They won the World Series. I guarantee you, if you went out on the street after this conversation and asked 10 people who the heavyweight champion of the world is, maybe one person could answer it. That's a shame. When Muhammad Ali, Joe Frazier, George Foreman were fighting, people knew who the heavyweight champion of the world was, because for most of that time, there was just one.
Well, Thomas, tell us, I mean, back in at the peak of his time, was Joe Frazier as identifiable as LeBron James or Tiger Woods or some of the big athletes of the day?
It's a different world now. You have so much social media, and there are so many visual images. Don't forget, when Ali and Frazier were fighting, you had television. And that was really
that
it.
That was basically it, yeah.
You couldn't go to YouTube 5 minutes after something happened and see it there. But certainly, Ali and Frazier were two of the most identifiable athletes in the world. They had the same sort of domination within the world of sports that players like Kobe Bryant and LeBron James have today.
And you know, the fact, Thomas, that we're talking about this today, right, that Joe Frazier passed away, I mean, that means something. Here we are 40 years after the fight of the century over at Madison Square Garden.
Yeah, and of course, a lot of the attention that Joe gets today is because of his relationship with Muhammad. Joe was a great fighter, but if you took the three Ali Frazier fights off his record, there wouldn't be a whole lot. He won a version of the heavyweight championship. He unified it against Jimmy Ellis. He beat Ali. Then he lost to Ali after he was turned into a yo-yo by George Foreman.
Mm-hmm.
And so really, even though there was a lot of ill will there, Joe owed a lot of his persona to Muhammad Ali, and Ali owed a lot of his place in history to Joe.
And of course, today, by the way, we probably, most Americans, if you were to go and ask them who George Foreman is, he's the guy who came up with the grill.
Exactly.
I have one myself, as a matter of fact. I remember, and you know, it's interesting because back in the 90s, I mean, I think even fighting has diminished in popularity or become, as you say, Thomas, more of a niche sport even since the 90s because, you know, you had Mike Tyson and you had Evander Holyfield and all the others.
Yeah, and you have to remember the health of a sport just doesn't come from the top. College football is huge, but it's not just because of the BCS Championship Series. It's because every weekend there are hundreds of games played across the country before rabid crowds. So you have the same thing with the National Football League. People are watching the NFL now. They don't wait for the big game at the end of the season, even though it all leads to that big game. You have a big fight this weekend in Las Vegas, Manny Pacquiao, who certainly is worldwide figure against Juan Manuel Marquez. But you have to have more than big fights on the radar screen for a sport to be popular.
Thomas Hauser, author of a lot of books on boxing, and we appreciate you joining us today to talk about the sad news that, that Joe Frazier has passed away. Thank you so much, Tom.
Thank you.
And now to Florida, Jeremy, where a maintenance man was checking the air ducts of a vacant house.
Yeah.
He came across two aluminum foil wrapped packets of cash totaling $20,000.
Whoa.
Surprise. Was it drug money? No. Organized crime? Uh-uh. Elderly woman hiding her cash? Bingo.
Didn't trust the banks?
I guess not. The home's last owner, a widow, had stashed her saved money throughout the house, and her plan was to tell all her kids where the money was right before she died. Well, she did, but apparently she missed a spot. Well, now news of the big cash find has police worried that greedy people might descend on the home and rip through all of the air ducts looking for cash. You never know. Remember, the same thing happened here in California. Whitey Bulger's apartment. There was a lot of cash.
Stashed in that apartment, in Santa Monica, I think, in that case.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. You're right. There's certainly not the legality involved in Florida as there was here in California. Today's a big day in the entertainment world. Not a movie or, Jeremy, a TV show coming out. Not even a Kardashian wedding or divorce.
Thank God.
Instead, video game publisher Activision releases Modern Warfare 3. This is the latest in the Call of Duty series. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports on how big it could really be.
The video game series Call of Duty is one of the highest grossing entertainment franchises of all time. The latest version, Modern Warfare 3, could out-earn the movie Titanic. And that's the movie that broke the billion-dollar barrier.
At 6:22, attacks were triggered across Europe.
Targets were key military and intelligence organizations.
Your job in the game is to help save Western civilization.
The symbols you have always looked to for strength are smoldering in Rome.
These games look real, and you can play with friends on a dedicated online social network called Call of Duty Elite. Fans who buy the game will drop at least $60, and on average will spend over 100 hours playing. Here's Eric Hirschberg, the CEO of Activision, at a conference in Cologne.
We as an industry are creating some of the most powerful and beloved pop cultural images and experiences of a generation.
They're selling the same stories again and again and again.
This is Call of Duty 8, I believe.
John Davidson's a vice president at GameSpot. He says the industry's addicted to sequels.
There are a number of games which, when you really kind of tot up the number of entries in the franchise that there have been, you know, there are some that are in double digits now.
But when you're asking legions of fans to spend hundreds of millions of dollars, it's dangerous to fall into a creative rut.
And because Call of Duty is in its, you know, eighth iteration, there was definitely some, let's call it, malaise.
Reviews have been a bit tepid. For now, though, this formula is still working for fans. Pre-orders for Modern Warfare 3 have been huge. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Well, Steve, when you were driving into work today, did you notice all the billboards on your right and your left, in front of you, behind you, everywhere you look in Los Angeles?
on the side of buildings, on the pavement.
That's right.
In most places
around the world these days, that's pretty much the same case. Yeah. Well, a new documentary that's premiering today at the Doc NYC Festival explores just how fast billboard advertising has taken over public space. It's called This Space Available, and we're joined now by the director, Gwenaëlle Gobet. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, let's focus on the specific. I drive by a famous building in Los Angeles all the time. It's on the corner of Wilshire and La Brea. It's an old building, and it's got a big lit-up Samsung billboard on the top. What is wrong with that in principle?
There's nothing wrong with buying and selling, but there is something wrong when wherever you go, whatever you do, you are treated as a consumer. There are places where that is appropriate, and there are places where that's not. There's a problem when students from a class don't recognize the trees that are in their neighborhoods, but if you show them an alphabet with just one letter picked out from logos, they will recognize every single brand.
But it's not just billboards that are doing that. Obviously, that's something that's coming from television and from magazines and from images that they see all over the place. Why are billboards so much worse in your mind than the rest of the advertising we see?
Because they're occupying a space that doesn't really belong to advertising. It belongs to everyone.
Well, let's talk about one of the most interesting parts of your film, which is Sao Paulo, Brazil, a place that has banned all billboard advertising.
I think there was just too much of it. And it wasn't about who was making the best message or the best advertising. It was who was putting up the biggest billboard in the most places. There's a story of a bank billboard being bigger than the actual bank building. You couldn't see the city because it was covered in billboards. The mayor passed a law, and then everything was down in 6 months, which was pretty radical.
Do you think that anything like that could ever happen here in the United States? I mean, in the advertising center of New York, for instance?
I really do believe that it could happen because it's not good for brands to be a pollution. I really believe in the passion of New Yorkers, and they love their city. I don't think they want it to look like any other city. I think they want it to look like New York.
Gwenaëlle Gobet, director of the new documentary film This Space Available, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And we've got clips from the film at our website, marketplace.org. Finally, Steve, to Scotland, where a fireworks company is apologizing after a technical glitch in a display last Friday night. It was supposed to last 20 minutes, the display was, but the company accidentally set off all the fireworks at the same time, so it only lasted 50 seconds. Now, they're going to do a makeup show at the end of this month, but frankly, I bet the 50-second show was pretty good.
That's an amazing thing to see. Yeah.
Exactly. Wow. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles. Have yourself a great day. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.